Good afternoon to this meeting of the Senate Resources Committee. Come to order at 3:30 p.m. in Butcherich, Room 205. Today is Monday, March 2nd. Members present today are Senator Coghill, Senator Bishop, Senator Giesel, Senator Rivak, and Senator Keel, as well as myself, Senator Machicki. Let the record reflect we have a quorum to conduct business. On our agenda today, we have Senate Bill 217, State Land Voucher, PFDs, Senate Bill 161, Geothermal Resources, HJR 25, Ensure Access into Denali Park, and we may get to Senate Bill 159. My priorities are Senate Bill 217 and HJR 25 today. HJR 25 has a clock running on it, so we'll talk about that after Senate Bill 217. So first we have Senate Bill 217, State Land Voucher, PFDs. Present the bill. We have Mike Barnhill, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Revenue. Ann Weske, Director, Permanent Fund Division, and Marty Parsons, Director, Division of Mining, Land, and Water. If you want to please join us up here and proceed with your presentation when you are ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mike Barnhill, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Revenue, and very happy on behalf of the administration to be here today to present SB 217, our state land voucher bill. I'm going to make a few introductory comments, and then Ms. Weske is going to take you through her slide deck, and Mr. Parsons is going to take you through his slide deck. I'll be available throughout for questions and then end our presentation with a few closing comments. So the basic concept of the bill is easy to say in one sentence. This bill provides the ability for a PFD applicant to elect on their PFD application to forego the cash dividend and in lieu of that elect a land voucher. The value of the land voucher is calculated as two times the statutory formula of the permanent fund dividend amount. They can take that land voucher and then present it at a land disposal sale of the Department of Natural Resources and purchase state land. The overarching purpose of this bill, Mr. Chair, is to get more land into the hands of Alaskans. This is consistent with comments that were made in the Constitutional Convention about getting land and natural resources made available to Alaskans, to all Alaskans, so that they can use it. With the benefit of enhanced access to land, Alaskans can use it to build homes on, use it to start businesses or continue businesses for agricultural reasons, to help all Alaskans achieve ultimately the hope of self-sufficiency. The concept of a land voucher program is fairly ingrained in our country's history. The federal government first used land vouchers to compensate American Revolutionary War veterans. Many states and the federal government have used it since, though it's been a while since states have used the land voucher program like this. You probably have to go back 100 years or so. But the whole idea here is to essentially provide a subsidy so that people can get better access to land. So with that, I'm happy to take questions or we can dive into the presentations.
Well, the only thing I would add to that is I think you can go back to the late 50s, right? Soon after the war when the Alaska had a homestead program for returning veterans, sort of similar to the Revolutionary War.
I will research that one. I'll be ready to answer detailed questions.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, Ms. Weske.
Hi, for the record, my name is Ann Weske. I'm the director for the Permanent Fund Dividend Division with the Department of Revenue. And I'm here to just share a little bit about the duties of the division when it comes to SB 217. So there's three core duties that I identified we would need to ensure. First of all is to provide a method for Alaskans to utilize the electronic application to make this choice. So they would be able to choose on the online application to forego the monetary amount of the PFD and go forward with a land voucher option. Secondly, I would also state that we would need to also calculate the statutory net income each year. So as you know, since 2016, we've not necessarily officially been calculating it, although we have been kind of keeping it behind the scenes. This would definitely be a public official calculation every year of what the statutory net income amount would be so that they can double that for the value of the land voucher. And then the third one is what we would continue to do as a division, which is to determine eligibility for Alaskans, also for the purpose of participating in this program. The considerations of the department, one of them is just, again, calculating out that statutory net income calculation, ensuring that all those numbers are triple-checked to make sure, because now we have an actual monetary value to the land voucher, so we'd want to make sure that that we're collecting all the numbers from APFC that we need to make that determination going forward. The second one is to ensure that only adults, this is only going to show up on the adult applications. You can't utilize this option when you're filing on behalf of another individual, or children are not able to utilize this option as well. And then thirdly, and there's more after this one, but the third one that we were thinking about is that all of our voluntary programs expire at the end of each calendar year. So if you apply for, say, PCLIC Give or Alaska 529 in January, your determination would have to be made during that calendar year, or at the end of December, we expire that, and anything that you would have chosen to give to those programs gets returned to you. As the applicant. And we would do the same with this. This does not mean, I just want to make sure we don't confuse it with any voucher expiration. There is no expiration on the actual voucher. This would just be to participate. Your eligibility would need to be determined. The division does determine roughly 98% of Alaskans by that point. The remaining amount is typically, they're kind of outlier situations, like competing children applications where we have adults who are kind of holding up that process due to legal situations going on in their lives. So for the most part, that wouldn't be a concern, but I did want to make sure that that was clear in this situation.
Any questions before we move on? Because I have a couple. One is, what if the statutory net or income calculation changes in the statute?
Mr. Chair, I can pick that up. If the legislature,
Mr. Barnhill,
Mr. Chair, Mike Barnhill, Department of Revenue, if the legislature enacts a new formula, it would just, as long as the citation of the formula stays the same, it will just flow through into this. So,
Senator Bishop,
I'll take that one step further. So let's say the statutory calculation is what we have today, but the legislature only appropriates half of that. So which is going to be applied for the voucher, the statutory formula or what's appropriated by the legislature?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, the statutory formula. It's intentionally phrased that way so that the formula controls the face value of the voucher.
That could be a good deal for somebody.
Okay.
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, we hope this is a good deal for many people.
Ann Weske again. I will go ahead and continue through. So one of the other considerations was just the physical printing. So we're going to need to come up with a look and feel of what this voucher is. I've seen kind of some of the older documents that we have in the Department of Revenue. It's probably going to be a pretty intricate process to get this actual physical document printed up and everything. And then finally, garnishments. As you know, our division provides quite a bit of money to the state of Alaska or other agencies, government agencies, in the form of garnishments. This would fall below all of those when it comes to priority orders. So we would come up with a way to calculate whatever. If a partial PFD was garnished, we would have to come up with a calculation for the remaining amount and put a value of land voucher on that. So I'm guessing it would be if 50% of their PFD was garnished, then we would give 50% of the value of that land voucher to that individual. So
to clarify, 50% of the remaining half would be 100% of the statutory dividend if 50% were.
Correct, Mr. Chair, yes.
So I'm sorry to do this to you, but if you can go back one page. If you were ineligible for a voucher, how could you be eligible for a monetary dividend? I'm trying to, that one just kind of bubbled around in my head, and I you sort of described it with pick, click, give programs that where you may not be eligible, but I'm not sure how that fit in this case.
Sure, Senator. So what we would do, that would be if they were not determined eligible within the calendar year, but eventually became eligible. So not all, they would be in an undetermined status. If they're in an undetermined status by December 31st, then they would not be able to participate in this program because we need to be able to have the actual number of vouchers by that date.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
That helps.
Okay.
Yes, Senator Giesel.
Thank you. Moving back to page four. Yes, to page four, I think. Slide four? Yes. Why are you printing a paper voucher? I mean, those are so easily lost, and electronic documents are so much easier to keep track of.
So, through the chair, Senator Giesel, it's a judgment call, and we felt like to launch it at the beginning, it would be more cost-effective to simply do a paper voucher. It's kind of like a bearer bond. If you have it, you own it. And you can sell it to whoever you want, rather than set up an electronic tracking system and track it all the way through. In the fullness of time, that can be reconsidered. But we think that we can add anti-counterfeiting features to the paper in order to maintain the integrity of the program. And I think at least at the outset that will work just fine.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before we leave garnishments, I see in the bill that a creditor couldn't garnish the voucher itself, only the cash value of the dividend actually to be paid to those who choose cash. Any particular reason for that?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, again, a judgment call in terms of having to adjust the PFD system. We don't need to make any changes if the garnishments for all PFD applicants are handled in the exact same way. So if you, let's just use round numbers, $1,000 cash PFD, $2,000 voucher, everyone is subject to have that PFD, either cash dividend or voucher, garnished up to $1,000. So no changes need to be made to their system. Again, it makes it more cost effective. Everyone's treated the same. That being said, if someone wants to come along subsequent to when the voucher is issued and garnish the physical voucher itself, they can do that under Alaska law.
Follow up?
As I looked at the fiscal note, and I don't want to jump ahead, but they're certainly envisioned in the analysis the notion of a secondary market. So it seemed to me that in the case of garnishment, whether it be an individual who is owed money or whether it's, you know, the state getting child support for kids who need it, it would seem as though we're best served by getting the maximum value available.
Well, again, judgment call through the chair, Senator Keel. We felt this was the best place to start in order to keep it cost effective so we wouldn't have to make changes to the system. And just to reiterate, if child support wanted to garnish the physical paper voucher, they could say before the voucher gets mailed, they could say to the permanent fund dividend, we have the ability under Alaska law to take that voucher. Then, of course, child support would have a piece of paper, which they would have to do something with in order to get cash out of it. Maybe there's a secondary market, as you suggested, and they could sell it into the secondary market for cash. That's a choice they would make.
Questions, Senator Coghill?
It is an interesting point. So there's a hierarchy of garnishment. It may be a permanent fund. You just reiterate that hierarchy of garnishment.
Certainly. Through the chair, Senator Coghill, I don't have the exact priority list in front of me, but there, the IRS comes first, child support comes second, and then below that, it is posted online on our website, but I can certainly get that for you. I was going to just add a quick follow-up. Timing is an issue, kind of in the question that you asked. If they have a priority on their record, they basically if they have a garnishment on their record, the state land voucher doesn't really come into effect until after that garnishment is satisfied. So they wouldn't be able to participate, even if they choose it, they wouldn't be able to participate until after that garnishment was satisfied. So it wouldn't be, they wouldn't necessarily have, as Deputy Commissioner Barnhill stated, the $2,000 yet until after that garnishment was paid. I don't know if that helps clarify a little bit, but the garnishments take priority over the option of the state land voucher.
Mr. Chairman, that helps because I knew IRS was at the top of the list, and I was wondering how they were going to figure that value. So that probably does figure that up. However, it still leaves open the question how IRS will see the doubling of the value when it comes to people receiving value. And I don't know that we need to answer it now, but as we go through it, we're probably going to have to ask that question. So,
Mr. Chair, we have done some research on that, Senator Coghill. Our understanding, and of course, comes with the caveat that when it comes to personal income taxes, everyone should consult their tax advisor to get the best advice, but our understanding is that the land voucher would be subject to personal income tax up to the amount of the cash dividend. So in the example I just gave, they would take, just like everyone else, they would pay tax on that $1,000, and then the remaining $1,000 would not be subject to personal income tax, but at a later date, if the person were to sell the land, the capital gains tax would be on the full value of the land.
Okay. Continue, please.
Thank you. All right. So the cost to the department for the first year, excuse me, for the first year of implementation, there are a number of costs that go into starting up a program like this, as we've seen with other programs we've started kind of from scratch. There's some administrative work that will be needed, and we estimated roughly 60 hours to get, the logistics figured out. Advertising, printing, and postage, we put a little extra this first year for advertising, as we feel that it's important for Alaskans to be prepared for the options that will be provided to them on the application. And then the bulk of the work, of course, goes into our programming. We'll be needing to add it to the application. We need to find a method to route the funds where they need to go, adjust our internal database to reflect this as an option, and then, of course, display to Alaskans the status of their voucher in their MyPFD. So there's a number of upfront costs, the first year being $51,900. After that, it's more so maintenance. We'll still have some administrative costs. We'll have some printing and postage, and we'll include it in all of our advertising that we normally do, but we probably won't do as big of a push on education of what is this program. And then just ongoing reports that will be necessary to send over to DNR and various changes that we have to make just due to our own internal technology, so including the program in that. We believe it would cost us roughly $12,900 each ongoing year.
So I'm not seeing any other questions. How do you, and there have been questions in that direction, but you're issuing essentially a certificate, right? This voucher, paper certificate. You're going to keep records. How does the state have any, how would they track after the initial issuance of those vouchers as they go through, folks may be distressed and sell them several times, things may happen that make it difficult to track. So if someone walks in one day and says, no, I really own this, how is that going to work?
Correct. Mr. Chair, we're not planning on tracking them. So we're planning on printing them in a way that makes them distinguishable with anti-counterfeiting features, so that when they are presented to the Department of Natural Resources at a land disposal sale, they will just be accepted.
So, okay.
Without they'll have things like, you know, they'll have the value.
Let me finish my question, please.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Someone happens to break into their elder's safe where there's four vouchers, and they come to the next land sale and plunk them down, and you have no way to track whether or not they were sold, and it becomes some person's word against another. How is that going to work?
The Department of Natural Resources would accept land vouchers that are presented. So we are not planning on tracking them.
Okay. Continue, please.
Mr. Chair, that concludes my portion of the presentation. Hand over the mic at this point. There's no other questions for me at this time.
Questions? So far, I think it's an innovative idea, but you're dealing with essentially a proportion of a potential deed for a piece of property and treating them like cash.
Exactly.
Okay, thank you. Yes, I'm sorry. Thank you. Mr. Parsons, please continue.
Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Marty Parsons. I'm the director of the Division of Mining, Land, and Water. A lot of what we'll go through here will be somewhat duplicative as far as what the program does or doesn't do. But I thought I'd start with just a real quick look at when the governor says the one thing that the state of Alaska has is a lot of land. Gives us an opportunity to look at the total land entitlement that's been provided by the United States Congress as part of our Statehood Act and the amendments made there too. So we have about 105 million acres that were owed as through all the entitlements. That'd be mental health trust, that's university, that's what we call National Forest Community Grant, and our general land entitlement. We have received just a little over 100 million acres of that land so far, leaving us about 5.8 million acres that the federal government still owes us. As part of our land bank, which is determined by the classification process and our planning area planning, we have about 2.5 million acres in that land bank now. That doesn't mean it's all developable. That means it's that land that has been identified for settlement or for disposal. So you want to know who owns Alaska? Well, this chart has been fairly consistent over the last, well, say 8 years, where you've got the federal government owes about 62%, then you've got various percentages between the state, the Yangtze corporations, and that little tiny purple wedge is what we would consider private property, which is right around 1%. Well, it's not a lot, and I think that's one of the things that the governor has intended to increase, and this program provides us that opportunity to get more Alaska land into Alaskans' hands. So what kind of programs do we have at DNR, DMLW, that these vouchers would be used for? We have our regular land auctions where we have subdivisions. We put these auctions out. People have an opportunity for several months to look at the land, provide bids, and then at one point we open those bids and the high bidder gets the parcel. That's open only to Alaskans. So Alaskans get the first crack at buying Alaska land through the auction. Any land that's not sold as part of that auction goes into what we call the over-the-counter program, which you can go online, look through that inventory and say, I think I like that parcel right there. and you can put a credit card down. You can make a down payment. You can enter into a contract to purchase those lands that were not disposed of as part of the auction. One of the more unique programs that we started several years ago was the remote recreational cabin staking. And that's kind of a blend of a homestead program that we put a couple of sideboards on, so we've got a little bit better control as to where those lands are actually staked. So a person participating in that, we say set aside 60,000 acres that we've identified that would be a good area for this program to take place. We'll determine that maybe 15 authorizations are a good number. It gets people spread out. They're not packed in like you would be in a subdivision. Those folks then have the opportunity to go out and stake up to 20 acres on their own. And so then it needs to be staked. The state needs to go in and make sure it's staked properly. They need to start to develop it. We enter into a land lease with those folks for a while. And then after it's been surveyed and appraised, they're able to then enter into a land sales contract. And again, this would be subject to the voucher program as well. And then we have the ag sales, which is, of course, administered by the Division of Agriculture. And as I understand the bill, those sales would also be available for use of the voucher system. So again, we look at this, an adult individual who files for the PFD electronically would be able to receive one of these dividends. Voucher's worth twice the statutory value of the PFD, and it applies to those lands that are sold under the four programs that I just identified. I think one of the important things we look at here is it doesn't take effect until January 1, 2021, and that's really important to the division because it protects that about $19 million worth of contracts that we have out there that will continue to have a revenue stream coming in from the interest and the principal made on those. If it was to go back in history and you could go pay off your contract, that would significantly and we think quickly reduce that amount of money that we have that funds our land disposal income fund. So again, they can be used once, they are transferable. They can be combined with other vouchers, which is really, I think, a unique an idea. You look at a family of two adults and an adult child that wanted to either buy a piece of land for that child to start to develop a home. This would allow them to combine those three vouchers and in many cases turn those vouchers in and pay the entire amount for a parcel. The important thing I think also to remember is this can be combined with the veterans preference and the veterans discount. And the vouchers, obviously, from what we've heard from revenue, do not expire. We really believe that when we look at Article 8, Section 1, where we talk about, it's the intent of the state to develop its resources in the best interest of the people, that one of the ways to do that is to get those lands into Alaskans' hands so they can build homes, they can have recreational sites, even if it's nothing more than a tent platform, that they want to go out someplace and develop a moose camp that they visit on a regular basis. That gives them an opportunity to have that piece of land that they can then either use or if at some point they want to dispose of. Again, this program makes it very accessible for the purchase. And if we look across the country, while we're a large state with lots of acres, only 1%, that's the smallest percentage that there is in the country as far as private ownership. As been mentioned before, this has been brought forward a couple of different times. It is a response for a demand that's out there on how do we get more people involved in the land sales program. And we think, truly believe it's a win-win for the state of Alaska and the people. And that's it.
Thank you, Mr. Parsons. Mm-hmm. Questions, Senator Diesel.
Thank you, Mr. Parsons. So the state does have land sales from time to time. I mean, I get the brochure. But boy, are they remote. So the folks that, even though they have these vouchers, are going to have some pretty sophisticated transportation methods to get to some of these sites. What kind of response do you get to those land sales?
Senator Giesel, through the chair, that is a consideration. And one of the things we need to look at as well is if you look at lands that are along the road system, many of those have already been conveyed to municipalities as part of their municipal entitlement. So, you know, let's just take the Matsu along the Parks Highway. There's about a 3-mile swath on either side of the parks that has been conveyed to the Matsu as part of their land entitlement. So our land starts 3 miles out. But I think one thing it does is by, again, looking at twice the statutory calculation, you start to lower that bar. So that, yeah, maybe you do have to have a four-wheeler, or maybe you have to have some other type of remote transportation. But if you're going to be able to take $6,000, let's say, or $3,000 off the price of a piece of land, that starts to free up some of that other cash that you might have to invest in those other opportunities to get you out to those parcels.
Senator Giesel, follow-up.
So I appreciate that. But you just described that there's land ownership around pieces of these plots, and sometimes they're kind of challenging to get access across those lands. I'm thinking of Native corporation lands, village corporation lands, even municipal. So again, it just seems like it's a huge challenge to get to some of these pieces.
Senator Giesel, through the chair, one of the things that DNR must do when we sell a piece of land, and I think over the decades it wasn't as adhered to as much as we try to now, is that we have to have access. So we have to either be able to plat an easement or gain access across federal land or corporation land. In most cases, it's contiguous, and it may be a lake that you fly into, or it may be a river that you can take your boat up and then park along the, you know, along the shore and walk in, or have a four-wheeler there. Maybe snow machines in the winter. A lot of the land that we look at in the state, a lot of people just use for winter access, where they can take a snow machine. The wetlands are frozen. There's no damage done running the snow machine across that. So we work very, very hard to make sure that when we offer a parcel, subdivision, remote rec, even over the counter, that it has access to it for exactly that reason.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator. Other questions? Senator Keel?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you run us through the four categories of land sales we have now? About how many acres a year do we sell?
Senator Keel, through the chair, we sell approximately 200 parcels, and they average about 5 acres. So that's doesn't include the remote rec. That's just simply when we look at the subdivision sales and we look at the over the counter sales.
So then, how about ag sales?
Senator Keel, through the chair, I hate this answer, but it depends. In most cases, the last several years, it's been about 3 parcels that we have sold, and those can vary quite widely. I can get you the numbers over the last several years of what we've done. I just don't have to have them at the tips of my fingers, but I have a chart or a table that I can provide to you that shows all that.
That'd be great, if I may, Mr. Chairman. Can you talk to us a little bit about I think you said the over-the-counter sales the department has estimated market value. Can you give us a rundown? What's the relationship between market value and the state's realized value at the auctions?
Senator Keel, through the chair, depends on where it's sold. If you look at lands in the interior, let's say the Tok area, you may have a 10 or 15% bump on what our fair market value appraisal is. You go to Southeast and it can be 2 or 3 times what the appraised value is, because those lands are so scarce and they're highly valued. So there's no definitive number. It just so much depends on where the land sale takes place. You get in around the Matsu, you get into to the Kenai Fairbanks, where again you have a population center. Those will be maybe 20-25% over what the fair market appraised value is. When we sell them over the counter, it is for the fair market appraised value.
Other questions? Yes, Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mark. Mr. Parsons, the auction and the over the counter, don't we, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm going off on some faded memory, doesn't the state have the ability to finance those or carry the notes on that land now?
Oh, Senator Bishop, through the chair, absolutely. Okay. What we do is with either the land sale, the auction, or when we look at the over-the-counter, the remote parcel and the ag, all of those have opportunities that the state can enter into a contract with the individual to finance that land. And it's very generous. Basically, it takes an Alaskan ID if you're participating in the auction. It doesn't even require that if you're gotta be careful here. You can enter into an agreement to finance the over-the-counter sales.
With DNR. Thank you.
Yeah.
So I was interested in how the lands are selected. Like Senator Geisel, I sort of pore through every publication. I was wondering why the state doesn't have a process like the trust authority does, where you can actually make an offer on a piece of property if you're interested. Is that something that the state would ever consider, where perhaps someone's interested in a piece of property and DNR has it surveyed and platted, and then they have a fair market value, and then that piece perhaps, even if it has to go to competitive bid, where closer in properties may become available?
Senator Machicki, yes. You have the ability now to nominate a parcel of land, and currently under our statute, it goes up to a competitive bid. There's another land sale bill that has not been heard yet. There's opportunities there where people could actually nominate a parcel, look at it through a development of economic opportunities, that they would put a plan together, and the state would then enter into a lease with them and then sell it subsequently to that individual. So we are looking at that because we do our best to define those areas where we can define a subdivision, because it makes sense when you look at the cost to have it surveyed, when you have it appraised, when you start doing road construction, that type of stuff. The economies of scale is such that it makes sense to sell it as a subdivision. But there are opportunities that I know people are going to look for where they want a specific parcel. One of the things we try to balance, and we've seen this in the past where we didn't do a very good job of that, is in the 70s we had an open-to-entry program where everybody went wherever they wanted to and staked up to 5 acres, and families would stake 5-acre parcels around a lake. And what we wound up with is you wound up with a gauntlet between a major road and where the resources were, where that access was then blocked for the state to go after their resources as far as like timber, minerals, coal, those types of things. So we try to balance those, that we're not blocking some type of access, and so we're very, very careful when it comes to those individual parcels where those are identified.
Other questions? Senator Keel?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm working on the last sentence here in the slide, and I'm trying to figure out it sounds a little bit like, and maybe you can just help me run some numbers. It sounds a little bit like with a little bump in the resources that your department has to survey land and plat it, if it's selling for 10% over fair market, double fair market, 20% over fair market, depending on the region, it sounds like selling it at those prices and then realizing 25% of the sale price to the general fund, it's kind of hard to see the win for the Treasury, looking at the sentence there. Wouldn't we be better off to give you a bump in what you have to go plat neighborhoods, plat subdivisions, and have you sell them under the current terms today for fair market or something just over?
Senator Keel, through the chair, I think the thing we want to look at is that if we have a voucher and a portion of that is now traded for land, that difference, like, between what the appropriated permanent fund would be, and what this voucher is worth stays in the general fund. So it doesn't come out, it doesn't go into it. Trying to think how to explain this. I think that's just about the easiest way, is that money stays in the general fund. It can, and so we're trading a chunk of land for that dollars that would have been distributed out to the individuals.
So, Mr. Chair, I was going to touch on this when I go through the sectional analysis. It's in Section 5.
Mr.
So,
Barnhill.
Mr. Chair, Mike Barnhill, Department of Revenue. Got to get back used to the rhythm of these things. I apologize. So Section 5 provides that the foregone cash amount for the PFD lapses into the general fund. And in that regard, it functions sort of as a down payment, because that 50% of the value of the cash voucher, or the land voucher, goes directly to the permanent fund. In my example, that would be $1,000 that would go from the PFD fund into the general fund and function essentially as a down payment.
Understand? You need more,
Mr. Chairman, I don't.
Okay. You know what would be helpful is we have another meeting coming up. I would, with your background, perhaps you can give us a mathematical clarification for that last sentence. I get it. With 2.5 million acres, your average that you dispose is 5 acres. There's 500,000 possibilities, possibly, if it were all to be disposed in this program. It would be nice for you to explain your math on how the net to the state is the same or better, and that could be related to real dollars or essentially the time value of money when you think about purchasing something someday versus paying something today. So I think it would be helpful to understand that. This isn't finance, but before we move it on, it'd be nice to understand your math on how this is beneficial.
Mr. Chair, happy to do that. But just very quickly, that person that doesn't elect the $1,000 cash dividend, that $1,000, instead of going to the person, goes to the general fund. And that person gets the $2,000 voucher.
Senator Giesel.
Well, two questions. Mr. Barnhill, you're certainly the expert on where money moves, but you said the money would go from the permanent, from the dividend fund to the general fund. It will actually be going back to the general fund. If I'm not mistaken, it's appropriated to the general fund, and then it goes to the permanent dividend fund, permanent fund dividend fund. But regardless, my question was actually for Mr. Parsons. So, back in the day, this is a little off, but you talk about subdivisions that have been platted. So what that reminds me of is the community of Willow. And we were going to build a capital there. And the land was subdivided, and rudimentary beginnings of roads were constructed. Is that state land? And is it ever offered up for sale?
Senator Giesel, through the chair. We do have some land in the borough. We have other issues that we're trying to work through as far as cost for development on that, which again is in another bill that I think will probably be coming before your committee. But yeah, there is some land in Willow. There's some land not too far out of Wasilla. There's lands within each of the Kenai, Fairbanks, North Star boroughs that we can offer. It's just a matter of right now it's the return to the state, and can we do it where we're not actually going in the hole trying to sell the land because the development costs are so high.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I noticed how you didn't touch the capital question
even
a little bit, which was brilliant, I think. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Along the lines of coming back for the next meeting, explain the cash flow, if you could put that in a form of a schematic as well to follow the cash flow.
Happy to.
Thank you.
I think that would be helpful with Senator Giesel's question as well. Senator Coghill.
Maybe this goes to things we might think about next meeting as well. So people get a voucher that will create a trading stock, basically. I mean, you'll be able to not only trade it with the DNR, but you'll be able to trade it as a property value somewhere along the line where people might buy them from other people and create a situation where they want to combine a bunch of them, buy a piece of property. And that's probably okay until somebody comes in and says, my dollar, cash on the barrel head, is good for that piece of land, and mine being treated unequally. So this cash value that is double, and they've gone out and now got all their relatives and buddies and friends to give them their vouchers at a reduced price, somebody comes in with a $10,000 bill, and you got these vouchers worth, you know, $20,000 or whatever, he's going to say, how come my offer is invalid? And so it's just something we're going to have to deal with. I don't know if you've thought it through, but I can see where it would be a good trading stock, but I also can see somebody come in and there's a contest on a piece of land. Cash value versus voucher value might become an issue, just to let you know.
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, we have had some pretty interesting discussions internally about that very example. But rather than step on the toes of the Department of Law, I think it would be great to have them come and address, because I think the concern you raise is one that certainly will be raised. But we think there are valid answers to it.
Other questions?
Mr. Chairman, are we going to do a sectional analysis, or should we just jump ahead?
Are you prepared to?
I'm happy to do a quick sectional analysis for the committee, if you'd like. Does the committee have the sectional analysis document?
Yes.
Okay, great. So, Mr. Chair, Mike Barnhill, Department of Revenue. Section 1 amends AS 3805 with respect to the veterans' discount for land purchases to provide for multiple land vouchers being used. Mr. Parsons made reference to that earlier. Section 2 provides that the land vouchers and the land purchase with the land vouchers are the surface rights only. Sections 3 and 4 are really the guts of the proposal. Section 3 authorizes the Department of Natural Resources to accept land vouchers as payment for the purchase price of a piece of land. It also has reporting requirements and the ability for them to request additional money to replenish the land disposal income fund. Section 4 is the Department of Revenue, the permanent fund dividend authorization to amend their application so that a PFD applicant can elect to participate in the land voucher program. And it also provides that the amount of the land voucher will be 2 times the statutory formula for calculating the permanent fund dividend. Section 5, we just had a brief discussion. Yes, sir.
Mr. Barnhill, I'm a little bit worried about the 4325025 if the legislature changes the dividend program and it's no longer under that, if that statute no longer exists. Have you considered in the bill or current, and nobody out there take this as a, the letters will start immediately, but you know what I mean. We don't know what happens in the future. Someone decides to change an entirely different system or goes to a 50-50 or some completely, and that 430235 no longer exists. The bill doesn't seem to have language that says or current statutory calculation under another citation.
Mr. Chair, that's a completely fair suggestion, and I think we would be very happy to accept that as a friendly amendment to the bill. The entire purpose is that the land voucher be calculated based on the statutory value of the cash permanent fund dividend wherever it is enacted into law.
I think our drafter's expectation is that if there was a change in the formula, it would be the change to the formula would happen in that statute. But if it doesn't, the words that you offered are completely fine.
Thank you.
You bet. Going on to Section 5, this is the section that provides that the cash value of the foregone dividend lapses into the general fund, and the intention there is that it acts as a down payment. We'll bring back a cash flow example so you can see exactly how the cash moves between the permanent fund, dividend fund, and the general fund. Section 6 authorizes the commissioner to develop regulations. We also will report, the Department of Revenue will report on the number of land vouchers issued every year. Sections 7, 8, and 9 have to do with garnishments, and it goes to only the monetary value of the dividend is what is subject to garnishment, whether or not the person elects the land voucher. I do want to call the committee's attention to Section 9, and here this section makes it clear that the value of the land voucher is not subject to the Hold Harmless program for Medicaid eligibility. And the rationale for that is that the land voucher becomes an asset, and I'd be more than happy to have the Department of Health and Social Services come back and explain the complexity of this, but when it's an asset, then that ownership of that asset continues, and I guess there's a four-month rule in federal law. And so in order to avoid that complexity, what the Department of Health and Social Services will do is make sure that people understand before they elect the land voucher program, if they're Medicaid eligible, this will be counted as income.
Mr. Senator Keel.
Thank you. A couple of questions on that point. Mr. Barnett, is the land voucher for purposes of those federal programs income at cash value or face value? And same question for it as an asset for the asset exclusions.
Through the chair, Senator Keel, my understanding is it's face value, and that includes for the asset test as well. That being said, that is really the ultimate limit of my understanding of this issue, and would be much better served by having the Department of Health and Social Services explain this.
A follow-up for the Department of Health
Senator
and Social
Services.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In our imaginary secondary market, our hypothetical secondary market, if someone were to have one of these land vouchers who otherwise qualifies for a needs-based program, when they sell it, the sales price also income that excludes them from benefit?
Through the chair, you've blasted through my understanding.
Yeah, for the department to follow. Thank you,
yes,
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, for the department.
So those are good questions, and actually that's kind of one of my challenges with the lack of accountability, because you would have no record. And folks can say they purchased it for any price, and they can say that they sold it for any price because the department doesn't care. And I don't mean that. That's just the way you're looking at it right now. And I think you have a combination of face value and cash value. It's face value as long as the voucher has not been used to purchase land, but it's cash value upon purchase. So it's an interesting combination of terms. And I don't know how that would work with tax law or as far as DHSS is. We'll have to have them here and ask them how that would affect. And the reason I ask that is if a family of six, like mine, saves 3 years of, say, hypothetically, you have a $3,000 dividend, there's six of us, that's six times $6,000, $36,000 times three, you have an asset that's worth something, particularly if you use it to purchase a piece of state land.
So, Mr. Chair, I'm going to pass on all of those hypothetical rhetorical questions, but I will promise you we'll bring back experts that can join the conversation in earnest, with one exception, and that is the hypothetical that you just provided with kids, minors. They are not eligible to participate in this program as drafted.
Thank you for that clarification. So the most you could have is a family unless you combine with other adult children, would be the single that applied or the couple that applied.
Correct.
And adult children would be added to that as well.
Yes.
Thank you. I forgot that point. That's an excellent point. So I'd have to wait a few years for my 5-year-old to be able to participate. Okay, continue.
We appreciate your dedication to this program. let's see. I think that...
We're on Section 10.
Section 10. And this one is similar when someone is participating in... it's similar to Section 9. It would be counted as income for needs-based programs administered by the state or municipality. And then 11 is a conforming amendment to the PFD statute.
Okay, questions on the sectional? Seeing none, I think we'll cover the fiscal note at the next meeting when you discuss the cash flow and.
Happy to do that, Mr.
Approving the last sentence on slide 8, I think that is. I can't see that number from here, and my book is not open to it. Eight.
So, Mr. Chair, the Department of Revenue essentially did present its fiscal note in our slides. I don't know if the Department of Natural Resources has a fiscal note it would like to address. But we can bring that back next.
Chairman Chickie, we do have a fiscal note. Unfortunately, it's undetermined because we don't know how many are going to participate. We don't know. There's so many possibilities and permutations of how this could go that we haven't been able to put a solid number to it. That we know that there will be effect on cash flow, and it will affect the LDIF going forward, the Land Disposal Income Fund. But with the vouchers not taking effect until 2021, that pushes that farther out than the immediate effect that we originally thought.
Thank you. I think that's fair. And you understood my question, Mr. Barnhill, on including that with the $51,000 sounds like, how do I put this? When legislators want to do something like this, sometimes it's more expensive than when the administration wants to do something like this. I think that's a fairly fair statement. But if you think you can pull the program off mechanically for $51,000 for the first year, all power to you.
Okay.
Other questions? Well, I think it's a fascinating bill. I do believe that Alaskans are hungry for land. I actually like it. The administration has talked about back PFDs quite a bit in the last couple of years. Why is there not a so your effective date is January 1st of 21. That means that the last two fiscal years that the administration has had control of their part of the budget, this is not including back PFDs in value. It's moving forward from the effective date.
Correct, Mr. Chair. The primary purpose of this bill is to get land into the hands of Alaskans faster. One could make an argument that a byproduct of this bill is that it does provide some compensation for PFDs that weren't paid according to the formula, but that's not really what's prompting this bill. It truly is to accelerate the disposal of land.
Yes, Senator Rivak.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess if we're going to hear this again, one of the things I'd like to hear more about is what exactly the plan is in terms of issuing these vouchers out. I know we talked about it a little bit before, but I mean, would there be any identifiable? Would they be numbered and? Would it be trackable to the individual? I guess I didn't really understand how, you know, it could be that anonymous. So I'd like to hear more, if we could, Mr. Chairman, about what that's going to look like.
Mr. Barnhill?
Yes, sir.
Do you have an answer to that just for now, or are you going to bring that back at the next meeting?
I will be happy, I think, to bring back a mocked-up version of what one of these vouchers would look like. I don't know that we'll be able to get all of the anti-counterfeiting features into a mock-up immediately, but it will have features like a serial number and a name, and it'll look official, like a bond, like a bearer bond that other issuers have issued in the past.
Thank you. And I think the committee should consider if we support moving this bill along, which, again, I think it's out of the box, and I hear probably a couple times a week, many times from one family, that they would like to see opportunities for disposing of state land to Alaskans. I think that's great. I'm worried about the lack of trackability. I will just tell you that. And I don't know why you wouldn't include something in a fiscal note where transfers were recorded. You don't need dollar amounts, but I do think an official transfer is would be a very important piece of this program. I think it leaves itself wide open for theft and elder abuse and all kinds of things that come along with untrackable assets. So I think that's certainly something I'll be focusing on. So I'd like to hear your thoughts on that as we move through this. Yeah, Senator Bishop.
Just one final comment to Mr. Parsons. Do you think you'll have enough land to meet the interest?
Senator Bishop, Marty Parsons, Director of the Division of Mining, Land, and Water. It will be a challenge, and that it's one of the things that my staff and I have already been working on, is we will need to aggressively move forward with the decision making process to get those lands prepared, and we will also have to go back and look at some of the area plans that we've already had developed and see if there are lands adjacent to those that were identified as settlement and reclassify. So yeah, it'll be a bit of a lift, but I'm fully confident in our staff to be able to keep up with it.
Okay, seeing no, Mr. Barnhill?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to acknowledge your comments about the trackability, and I think they're fair comments, and we're happy to engage in further discussion on that. It was a judgment call on our part to not include that in effort to make this as efficient as possible, but happy to have further discussion on that.
Yeah, I mean, what should be clear is that over the years, a young family could forego receiving a permanent fund dividend and build up quite a portfolio of land vouchers and become prepared to purchase their dream piece of property, whether recreational or not, and find that something has gone horribly wrong. And without a tracking system, they're exposed in a way that not everyone keeps records equally. There's a wide spectrum between one being in the glove box until the truck is sold and it goes away, and others that may put them in a safe deposit box for a long time. So I think my concern is fairly clear. It becomes a pretty significant asset. So we can talk more about that. Thank you. I think it's a very interesting bill. I appreciate you bringing it forward. We'll get together some more on that, and you know the questions from the committee, so we'll look forward to
thank you very much
discussing. Yep.
Thank you.
Next, and I did not expect this bill to run as long, so we will likely only get through the next bill, and that is, so geothermal resources, the department is not ready for that bill. We're going to move into HJR 25. So with that, Representative Tallarico, if you can please join us and present that bill to us, resolution, if you will.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate this opportunity. Committee members, thank you as well for taking the time. I'm Dave Tallarico. I'm the representative for House District 6, which I will describe as the eastern interior of Alaska. I also have with me, if for any questions, my Chief of Staff, Tom Studler. Mr. Chairman, the resolution is encouraging the President of the United States, the United States Congress, and the governor of the state to assist the National Park Service in its efforts to ensure long-term access into Denali National Park and Preserve by way of the existing roadway. I'm sure you're all aware, Mr. Chairman, that Denali is Alaska's most well-known national park. The road into the park is a 92-mile long road that goes through the Alaska Range, goes through all of several different, I'll call them climate zones, several different areas in the park. I hope some of you have had a chance to travel that road. There are certainly opportunities for people to view wildlife. I mentioned in my sponsor statement, this is roaming, unfenced land. Animals aren't put away at night and let out in the morning. This is completely natural. People do get an opportunity to view the peaks of Denali, probably not as much as they would like sometimes, but there's also some incredible landscapes all along the way. The road that we're referring to is the only access into the Kantishna area, which is, they refer to them as inholders now. Of course, at one time, the Kantishna area weren't inholders. They were on the edge of the park. When I was a young man, they were just outside of the park, kind of on the, it would be the northeast side of the park. Since that point in time, back in, I want to say 1978, there were park additions and preserves put onto the park, and it has made that area an inholding within the park. Without this road, they have no road access into that particular area. I'll also mention, and I don't have this in my sponsor statement, Camp Denali / North Face Lodge, Kantishna Roadhouse, Backcountry Lodge, and Skyline Lodge Kantishna Air are based back in the Kantishna area. So it's a very, very busy, very active commercial area in the summer. So keeping the road access into the park is for the enjoyment of residents of the Kantishna area and visitors alike, and it's very significant to those who plan to travel to Alaska. There's a section of the road at mile marker 45.4, which I think some of you would be familiar with, the Polychrome Pass area, to climb up the Polychrome Pass. That has become increasingly unstable and needs immediate attention. So I would urge support of House Joint Resolution 25 so that we can encourage action on this significant piece of infrastructure. And I would add to that, Mr. Chairman, that there are many, many itineraries for visitors that include a visit into and a trip into Denali National Park. This particular section of road is east of the Eielson Visitor Center as you travel in west. So if we lose this part of the road, or we can't get past this part of the road, folks won't be able to get to the Eielson Visitor Center, which is a significant destination on many of the itineraries. And just a few years ago, I believe Senator Bishop and I actually had the opportunity to visit the Eielson Visitor Center. It was under some serious construction, and we got to see the construction they were doing and the expansion. It's been very good. I would also mention that we do have a thing called the Road Lottery, which many of our residents enjoy every year. People apply to do that and go back on the Road Lottery, which lasts several days. Lots of people apply. I, unfortunately, have not ever been successful in getting a lottery ticket, but I do know people that have. But I have had the opportunity in a previous position to travel into the park on an annual basis. I've been in there many times. They also do provide a point in time where our active duty military get to go into the park without paying the fees in the park. And that's been kind of attractive, in particular for the folks that are stationed at Fort Wainwright, Clear Air Force Station, Eielson Air Force Base. So it's a very important piece of infrastructure. It does mean a lot to our tourism business and their activity, so I would urge support. And, Mr. Chairman, I would be happy to attempt to answer any questions.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Tallarico. Any questions for the representative or his staff? Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, Representative Tallarico, this morning Senator Bishop and I were talking, and he was commenting that there aren't many of us that can call ourselves old-timers anymore. They're passing away. So I loved hearing you say back in your younger years. But my question is, is there a proposal for stabilizing that area? It looks like a pretty unstable slope. What are your thoughts there?
Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Giesel, I have had contact with the park superintendent, and I am aware of, he has testified before, that they have looked into several different plans. The plans that I'm aware of, they have actually talked about the potential of driving piling or possibly a little bit of a relocation of the road, although that would be a little more than a little bit because of that particular location. But I know they've looked into several different alternatives, and I think they're still pursuing quite a few of those and looking at them. Over the years, you're correct, what they've kind of done is they've, you know, filled in the cracks and monitored very closely this I refer to it as a slump. I know Senator Bishop is familiar with that term, this particular area of the road that seems to be sinking away. At this point, it's my understanding that it's, rather than just moving a few inches, it's moved quite a few feet. So that's their big concern. But I know they've talked about several different ways that they think they can stabilize this. So I know they're still actively pursuing those as they move forward. I think probably their biggest concern will be the crunch for time, you know, because of the timing of all of this. But it's certainly, it's a magnificent piece of road unless you don't like heights, and then it's nerve-wracking for sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Other questions? Seeing none? Okay. On HJR 25, what is the will of the committee, Mr. Vice Chair?
I think we should speak right up, Mr. Chairman. I move that we move the HJR 25 version 31LS1472M from committee with individual recommendations in the attached zero fiscal note.
Is there any objection? Hearing none, HJR 25 moves from committee. As soon as my staffer gets back, we will pass it around for a signature. In the meantime, I'm actually going to open public testimony. I'm sorry, I skipped the line on Senate Bill 217. I did not have anyone signed up, but perhaps we do. So this is on Senate Bill 217, and we'll bring it back for public testimony at the next meeting. But this is the state land voucher bill. Would you like to testify?
Yes, I will.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you. And I know the drill. Vicki Jo Kennedy, I'm still in Juneau, three sessions, but my home is Kodiak Island. Well, I like the whole idea of being able to buy land with our vouchers. I thought it was great. Until I showed up in here today and had to deal with the DNR and the revenue, and the only thing that could make this a total foobar is when DHSS and the Department of Law gets up in here. I do have some questions. And they're for DNR, and I hope you guys listen to me carefully. There is some land on Kodiak Island. There's very little of it that's in the hand of the public sector, very little of it on the road system. We are the second largest island in the United States, but only 80 miles of road is available. Now, Ted Stevens, that's dead Ted Stevens, he gave a lot of land away to a corporation in Kodiak, a tribal corporation, called Lesnoy. They gobbled up 350 square miles of land on the Kodiak road system. There's hardly nothing left. But there is good land, and it's at Narrow Cape. And I think most of you know where I'm going with this. What's at Narrow Cape? The rocket launch. They swapped that land. This all started in 1993 when I was still out there. It's going to be a 200-acre site. It's currently standing at 3,800 acres, and most of that land does still belong to the state through the DNR, the part of mental health lands, and, oh, and the University of Alaska. Supposedly, it's been leased. Now, this nobody can seem to give any of the girls that do this computer stuff. I just come here and try to pay attention, try to stay sure, but it's hard to do. Is that land going to be for sale? Because it is state lands. Louise is interested in this, too, because, like she said, yeah, we have some land in Kodiak. We'd be glad to let people buy it with their vouchers, but we don't even have a ferry to get to it. Now, they did sell some land in Kodiak through the DNR. And it was right across from the rocket launch in UGAC Bay. So in case, you know, something happens, boom, guess what? Anyway, I just want to know, this land voucher, I'm very moved by it. I think it's a great idea. But I'm confused by some of this stuff in here. It says it'll start being accepted on January 1st of 21. Well, I already signed up for my PFD, and I do it paper, because me and computers don't get along very well. So am I going to be eligible on January 1st, or do I have to run over there and get them to pull my paper ballot and reapply electronically? I mean, there was a whole lot of questions here today, and you guys asked great ones, and I sure appreciate a good committee. So when does it go up on the block for sale? It says here on page 5 that it'll start January 1st of 21, which is next January. So we didn't even have it on the click, pick, give yet. So how can it go on the ballot on the 2021? I'm just confused. And I saw a whole lot of smoke and mirrors up in here today, and I'm not very happy about it. I think it's a great idea that we can buy land with our vouchers, but there are issues here and there are problems. And the whole thing about tracking them, if somebody does steal it, there are problems. Yeah, let's get the Department of Law in here, you betcha. But I'm all for it. I think it's wonderful. I actually shed tears when the governor announced that this was going to happen. I thought it was great. I'll be happy to give my PFD to own a piece of the rock, and that's what we lovingly call Kodiak. So thank you for listening to me, and yeah, I had a history. I ran to Miss Liz. So I thank you guys very much, and do bring this back. Thank you for your wonderful questions.
Thank you very much, Ms. Kennedy.
You're welcome.
We have another individual online from Eagle River, Chris Eichenlaub. I believe I said that correctly, but please correct me when
this is Chris Eichenlaub for the record. It's SDE 217. I'm liking it. You know, it's always better when you can get people to voluntarily give you their cash rather than, you know, do a money grab. You know, we need to stay away from those money grabs because they really don't solve anything. This actually solves something. And then we can actually get to, downstream taxation, you know, get a little bit more out of it. So this is going to be the gift that keeps on giving, and I like it. And it's not mandatory, you know. Nobody's being forced to give up their money, so it should be a win-win all the way around. I like it. Any questions?
Questions for Mr. Eichenlaub? No, thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony. Thanks for calling in. We are we're going to leave public testimony open for the next meeting. We have 12 minutes left. We were going to hear Senate Bill 159 another time, and we have individuals here. I hate to waste their time. If we ran a couple of minutes over, are folks okay on the committee? We'll expedite a discussion. But if we can bring that same team up, please join us up here. I know I have a couple of questions for you. Senate Bill 159. We first heard this bill on February 28th, where we had a presentation and open public testimony, and we set the bill aside for further consideration. I have not received any amendments. Is there any questions for the department? Seeing none, I have a question for you. I was going to amend the bill because of a situation we discussed, but if you can talk about that situation on the record where you believe that's been solved by the department, and we talked about a specific case where a guide was asked for an unreasonable to sort of unreasonably determine that someone was telling him the truth when there was no way for him to control that outcome. How would that be handled in the future when it comes to a providing false information or a false report?
Mr. Chair, for the record, Tom Tobey, Deputy Director, Division of Sportfish.
The case in which you're referring was actually a citation provided by a different department, DNR Parks, and since that time, our Alaska Wildlife Troopers have spoken with the enforcement of DNR Parks and requested that they only enforce the regulations of the Department of Fish Game as strictly as they themselves do. At this time, if someone was found, a guide was found that they had a client that the parents had said this person's under the age of 16 if they were non-resident or under age of 18, and the individual claimed that as well, the guide would not be held for that because it would be the person themselves falsifying or the parents falsifying the information, not the guide. The guide is would not be required to, other than asking if the person was of legal to have a license or not have a license, that would cover their requirement. They wouldn't be, need to have someone provide a birth certificate to verify their age. And so I think we've addressed the concerns, mainly communications between the different departments to make sure that, we're not having enforcement beyond what's the expectation of the regulatory language.
And I think folks understood the issue. They were asking Kenai River Guides in this case to ask for more identification than TSA requests when you're traveling with your children. So I'm glad the way it was resolved. Is there a consideration for a regulatory change so that we don't have to worry about that in statute to clarify that issue?
Mr. Chair, not at this time. In the conversation I had with Alaska Wildlife Troopers, they thought that the situation had been resolved by having the discussions. I think from the department's perspective, it's something we would try to have annual meetings with the different entities that might be providing enforcement to make sure that doesn't happen again, so we're all on the same page to start the season.
Okay. Thank you. I'm satisfied with that. Are there any other questions for Mr. Taube? Okay, with that, we still have public testimony open. I have one person online. That is Forrest Braden with the Southeast Alaska Guides Association. Mr. Braden, are you available?
I still am. I'm here. Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Forrest Braden for the record, and I'm testifying on behalf of Southeast Alaska Guides Organization. And I'll make it short. We're in support of this bill, operator guide licensing bill, and I've known about this for a little while, and I've had several conversations with the Department of Sport Fish on the expense associated with running the program registration and logbook that this bill would fund. And I'll admit that at first I was startled that they were suggesting that we increase the licensing fees, that we double them. But I'm fairly satisfied after asking a lot of pointed questions to the department about specifically how the budget works and how these funds are directed and the labor and materials and costs involved in the program. So I've even gone so far as to kind of take my own business model and break it down to the logbooks and the stickers and licenses that are issued and the number of logbook pages that I typically submit to the department and the kind of the processing that it takes to go through then manually enter those. And I could see how these fees are reasonable. As part of my work for Southeast Alaska Guides Organization, I immerse myself in the numbers behind the operation of our industry. It's really critical to know who's participating and what level they're participating at, and it's super critical to know how many anglers are participating in the fisheries through our charter industry and what they're harvesting. And the bottom line is we need the data collection. It seems fair and reasonable that we as an industry would bear the burden for the cost of the administration of the program and that it would be cost neutral to the state and to the department. So for those reasons, we'll support the bill and encourage its passing. That's it. Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Braden. Any questions for Mr. Braden? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony. I see no one else. Is there anyone else in the room that would like to testify on Senate Bill 159? And there's no one else online. With that, I'm going to close public testimony and ask for the wishes of the committee.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to make a motion to move the Senate Bill number 159, version 31GS2192, version A, from committee with the individual recommendations in the attached fiscal notes.
Is there objection? Hearing none, Senate Bill 159 moves from committee. I want to thank our LIO moderator, Brett Mello, and Chris Dickrell with Senate Records, and my staff, Conrad Jackson, for your work here today. As there is no further business, before I say that, please remember that so Wednesday we have a briefing on the coronavirus. We are going to have a brief meeting when that meeting is over at around 5 p.m. just because we have a group that's coming in that we could not be rescheduled. I expect it to be maybe 30 minutes. Please remember that for Wednesday. Those the other bills we were going to hear will be shifted to another schedule. So as there's no further business before us, this meeting is adjourned at 4:55 p.m. 4:55 p.m.